Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are blessed each week with the uncommon intelligence of Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, who has also authored three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back. Diana, I'm going to be talking throughout the show, I think, today about a proposition that is now being actively debated, and I think necessarily so, which is that the Chinese Communist Party, whether it designed this virus for the purposes of attacking the United States, that we certainly can't definitively say at the moment, but it does seem as though the timeline indicates that they knew what they had on their hands long before they told us, and that as a result, they took advantage of a window in which the rest of the world was not steeled against this deadly disease, and they were busily moving it out to the world, including to our own country. Fortunately, not as much as they might have had President Trump not acted to shut down some of the transits here. But Diana, what do you think of this and the pushback that it's now getting from some quarters that there's nothing to see here, folks, move along?
I think it's 100% certain that the Chinese knew what they had and what they were deploying to the world through airplane travel and who knows what else. So what really becomes my concern at this point, in addition to that obvious national security concern, which has exposed the fragility and danger to our supply chains and all the rest of it, is how the Western governments have reacted to this news. A, the suppression we see certainly in media circles and in sectors of the left and the rest that see this as conspiracy theory and a way to hit at Trump and deflect from his measures to counteract that. But what we are also watching is this tremendous synchronicity in governments, local, state, and federal, and central across the Western world to essentially carry out a very Chinese-style seizure of power from the people, an attack on sovereignty that is beyond anything that I have ever imagined happening in the name of our health. I mean, this is sort of a revolution by stealth, by health. And what I consider it more and more is something along the lines of a corona coup.
The corona coup addressed not just to the government of the United States, but really to all of our constitutional rights and freedoms. I'm reminded of this business with YouTube now telling us that the World Health Organization will dictate what we can actually see on that particular platform. Mark Zuckerberg is doing the similar thing. So, Diana, when you're talking about this, you're really speaking of something that I was struck by, presaged by a tabletop exercise, as it's called, Event 201, back in October of 2019, at least a good month before this virus began circulating in Wuhan, China, in which globalists and the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and, interestingly, the Chinese Center for Disease Control came together. It's all on YouTube, at least I think it is, even though it may violate some community standards, heavens knows, ours. It laid out really how a coronavirus pandemic could be exploited by such folks to enhance global government and to strengthen the World Health Organization and to divert resources into, you know, these kinds of enterprises. Did you see this, and did you take away from it something that further reinforced the kinds of concerns you just expressed?
Absolutely. This was a landmark moment going back to, I believe it was October or November of 2019, where this gathering did exactly as they tabletop planned this. But it goes back even farther than that. We can look back at the Rockefeller Foundation report of 2010 that was gaming out pandemic scenarios that planned down to the point of face masks and temperature checks and all manner of suspension of individual rights in their scenario planning. This is something that has been foremost in the minds of these people we refer to as globalists, New World Order enthusiasts. That is not a conspiracy phrase. That was one of the favorite catchphrases of Herbert Walker Bush's presidency. I mean, this is going back a great deal of time. So YouTube, you mentioned, they literally took down a viral video that was made by two respected and experienced doctors in California, Dr. Erickson being one of them, that was questioning the need for lockdown, looking at the figures that they had personally gathered in terms of treating COVID-19 in California, the mortality rate resembling a flu season and not requiring the kind of suspension of commerce and liberty that the government has seen fit to impose. So, I mean, this is the censorship that's going on with big tech, the revocation of rights by our governments with no end in sight is absolutely a takeover of a sort that the world has not seen before. And meanwhile, now we are also looking at dangers in our food supply chain, not just our medical supply chain going back to China, but our own food supply is being threatened by these same policies, creating bottlenecks and calls on farmers to kill, euthanize animals, and turn over crops into the ground rather than market. So serious, serious warnings are should be flashing.
Yes, indeed. And it is worth noting that some of those food processing plants, the president's now acted to keep them open. He's getting some pushback about doing that, but he is trying to maintain productivity there. Some of them are owned by communist China. The Smithfield foods have been bought by China, and it does raise this question, even in our own country, whether these supply chains are going to be viable for meeting the needs of the American people. And I think, Diana, against the backdrop of what you've said, that we are looking at a coup, or we're looking at least a concerted effort to use this pandemic as a pretext for imposing controls on our society. And it's sadly not exclusively Democratic governors or mayors. It's across the board. And it just makes so clear that we have to restore the confidence of the American people that they can safely operate in this country. And I'm very hopeful that even this week we may see announcements of very important developments on the health front that will give back the public that confidence and hopefully enable us to begin ratcheting down this lockdown. And again, not just opening it to, you know, businesses to operations again, but ensuring that people want to go, you know, frequent them and schools and other places of employment and entertainment and so on. This is what's needed to get our country back clearly, and we'll be hoping everyone will be watching this space, among others, for information along these lines. Diana, we are out of time. I'm sorry to say thank you so much for yours, as always, and we'll look forward to visiting with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about these issues and what the Chinese knew and when they knew it and what it all means for us, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for, well, one of the highlights of this show, which is our weekly visit with Gordon Chang. Gordon is widely regarded, I think, particularly at this moment, as an indispensable resource for us all on what's going on with China and with this pandemic that it has unleashed upon us. Gordon, of course, is a highly accomplished author and commentator with three books to his credit: The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. He is also a frequent contributor to places like The Daily Beast and to National Review and Fox News and so on. But we're also so appreciative for his regular contributions here. Gordon Chang, it's good to have you with us. I hope people are following you at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter as closely as I trust they are in all of your other media outlets. Good to have you with us, sir. I wanted to start with a question that I started discussing with Dinah West in the previous segment. We'll discuss with Brad Thayer shortly. This idea, which I think Senator Tom Cotton has particularly focused our attention on, that the Chinese knew before they let on to everybody else what they were dealing with in terms of this dangerous virus. I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus. And during that interval between when they figured it out and when they let the rest of the world know, they sent hundreds of thousands of Chinese from Wuhan and other parts of China to other parts of the world. This rises, I think, effectively to an attack on the rest of the world. Would you agree?
This was an attack on the world, Frank. Chinese officials admitted that COVID-19 was human-to-human transmissible only on January 20. But doctors in Wuhan knew about that second week of December, so Beijing knew about it shortly thereafter. Now, if China had said nothing about human-to-human transmissibility during that 5.5 or so week period, it would have been grossly irresponsible. But what China did was try to convince the world that it was not H-to-H, human-to-human. And so, therefore, health officials around the world were lulled into not taking precautions that they otherwise would have adopted. And to make this worse, which is what you just talked about, Frank, is that China pressured countries around the world to not impose restrictions and quarantines on arrivals from China. So that's how this disease spread.
And they used the World Health Organization to echo that and further reinforce the idea that this was the authoritative view of what we were dealing with. It's dangerous and malfeasant.
Yeah, the WHO on January 14th issued that tweet which said that based on information from China, there was no clear evidence of human-to-human transmissibility. And also the WHO on January 10th issued the statement criticizing countries for imposing travel restrictions, saying that they shouldn't do that. Also, the WHO blessed China's low infection and death statistics, which made the disease appear not to be that important and wouldn't become a pandemic.
And I think encourage people not to think about wearing face masks as well. I mean, it just went on and on, which raises this question, Gordon, on the WHO issue of, as I was discussing with Diana, what's up with the idea that we ought to let them be the arbiters of what is approvable content on platforms like YouTube, for heaven's sakes?
Yeah, well, that's a U.S. issue, and YouTube management needs to be severely criticized for elevating WHO sentiments as being the only official truth. When we look at the WHO, it was complicit in this deliberate spread of coronavirus. You know, if Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, we don't know what was in his mind, only he does. But if after seeing all of the disease in China and how it crippled his own society, if he wanted to level the playing field by spreading the disease elsewhere, he would have done what he in fact did do. And that leads us to believe, and we can infer, that this was a malicious attack on the rest of the world. And Frank, this was the first time in history that one country attacked all the other countries at the same time. So this is a crime against all of humanity.
Indeed. It really is arguably a war crime, because I think as you do, Gordon, they've been at war with us for quite some time. But really, to do this on a global scale really makes it a world war, not just an attack on this country. Let me ask you about a couple of other things. Gordon, you've been tweeting about a number of things that are now becoming apparent, that bad guys have been exploiting this. It's the Chinese, most obviously, but others have as well. Give us your thoughts on the degree to which not only have we been subjected to this attack, but we are now finding our vital interests affected by it worldwide.
Yes. Beijing, especially Xi Jinping, believes that China's the world's only sovereign state, and he saw this as an opportunity to further propose that view, basically by attacking not only our democracy, not only democracies, but the whole concept of democracy itself. So we see unrelenting attacks from Beijing. The most recent was from the foreign ministry, where you had a senior official say that the Trump administration response to coronavirus was slow, therefore blaming everything on us. This is an attempt to divide the American public. What the foreign ministry doesn't say is that, yes, everyone's reaction was slow because China tried to deceive people into believing this would not become a pandemic. And we've heard from Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator, that she looked at the infection and death numbers from China and was convinced that this was nothing worse than SARS, the 2002-2003 epidemic. And only when she saw what the coronavirus was doing to Spain and Italy did she realize that she was wrong. And during that interim, she did not recommend precautions that would have reduced the effect of the disease on the U.S. And by the way, Dr. Anthony Fauci has said this, basically the same thing about looking at China and being deceived. So this was an attack, and we're seeing it every single day from Beijing, Frank.
You know, I wanted to ask you about this, Gordon, because you're deeply schooled in the ways of the Chinese Communist Party. What you've just described as a deliberate campaign to deceive through their various propaganda arms and the resonance that those, you know, deceptions get in our media was evident to me this morning. I was listening to National Public Radio's reporting of this thesis that this disease may have emanated from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And it was as though it was the straight party line out of Beijing. I have to say that there was a conspiracy theory that this lab had anything to do with the virus's, you know, provenance, and that if anything, the scientists and people who were knowledgeable about the ways of these labs have insisted there's no way, no possibility that a disease like this could escape from the lab. Knowing what you do, Gordon, and I'm not saying you're a specialist in epidemiology by any means, but you're pretty knowledgeable about these issues, and most especially about the ways, as I say, of the Chinese Communist Party. What is your estimation of, well, at least the possibility, if not the likelihood, that that virology lab was indeed involved?
The most probable explanation is that this was an accidental release of a coronavirus from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The most damning evidence is that The Lancet, which is the authoritative British medical journal, on January 24 posted an article that said that about a third of the initial coronavirus cases had no contact with the wet market, which means that the wet market could not have been the source of this pandemic. Then the question is, well, what was the source? Well, we know a couple of other things, Frank, that this institute stored more than 1,500 strains of coronavirus. We know that the State Department investigative teams went there in early 2018. They were alarmed by the failure of the institute to adhere to protocols and safety procedures. We saw the pictures from China Daily, an official Chinese media outlet, of the refrigerator where the coronavirus was stored. And those pictures show that the seals on the door were broken. Those pictures have since been taken down. But that is evidence that this could very well have occurred from the lab. You know, at this time, we can't put our hands on our hearts and say it was from the lab. But most of the evidence points in that direction. And the evidence suggests it could not have come from the wet market. So putting two and two together, NPR is absolutely wrong if they said that.
Well, wrong, and I believe advancing the interests of communist China by disseminating this false information. Gordon, let me ask you lastly, very quickly, Kim Jong-un, you've written about his policies, the Nuclear Showdown book. You have been warning about the agenda of Moon Jae-in in South Korea. Give us just a minute, if you would, your current reading of the lay of the land there.
Well, something is obviously wrong because Kim was a no-show for two important events. The April 15th Day of the Sun, commemorating the birth of Kim Il-sung, regime founder and the grandfather of Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un has never missed a Day of the Sun celebration since he took over at the end of 2011. He also missed Saturday's 88th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Army. We don't know Kim's state. He could be dead. He could be alive. He could be in a coma. He could have coronavirus. He could be just trying to prevent himself from getting coronavirus. He could have had a cardiac arrest, or he could have been injured in an April 14th missile launch that he apparently witnessed. Any of those things, Frank, could be true. I think he happens to be alive. I tend to believe it's on the more serious end of the range of the possibilities, but we really won't know. And one other thing, Beijing and Seoul had been trying really, really hard to convince the world that Kim is alive and well. They've been trying too hard, and that really raises suspicions about what's going on. But at this time, you know, we only know that something is amiss.
Something is amiss. That may be a good thing. We'll see. But the connivance between South Korea and North Korea is very, very troubling, Gordon. And this is the subject, of course, of your terrific newest book, Losing South Korea. We'll talk with you more about that next week, I hope. In the meantime, my friend, thank you for today and stay well. Next up, we'll speak with Bradley Thayer about this attack from China and Kissinger's folly, which has contributed to our present parlous state vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined by a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China by the name of Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a professor of international politics at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and the author of a really important book, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power. Brad, I'm always grateful for your time, but particularly so in light of two pieces that you've written recently that I want to visit with you about today. Thank you for joining us. It's good to have you as always. The first is a piece that you wrote in The Hill newspaper entitled Kissinger's Folly: The Threat to World Order is China. Henry Kissinger is frequently a topic of conversation on this program because I think he has done incalculable harm to the national interests of the United States over decades with the Soviet Union before the present impasse with Vietnam, for that matter, before the present conflict with China, but most especially, arguably, with respect to what he's done to confuse, to mislead, to enable the Chinese Communist Party's, well, ambitions globally, as well as vis-a-vis this country. Talk us through Kissinger's folly, if you would, please.
Certainly, Frank. Well, we start with the old joke, of course, that doctors bury their mistakes, right? But we also argue that that should be amended. Sometimes former statesmen try to bury their mistakes as well, and Kissinger is the masterclass in this. Kissinger has advocated an incredibly close connection between China's economy and the U.S. economy going back over a generation now. He has been an apologist for the Communist Party of China. He's turned a blind eye, as well as many others as well, to the activities of the Chinese Communist Party in international politics. He is the major advocate of the school of thought, which argues that China should be brought into the international order. We should, that is, the West should work with the Communist Party of China to facilitate its growth, the growth of China. And by so doing, it would become a responsible stakeholder in the international order. That was the logic. That logic has been seen as a profound mistake, right? And he's attempting now to try to bury it, but we're not going to let him do that. We recognize that was wrong. It was a profound, grand strategic mistake made by the United States. In a historically unprecedented act, the West actually contributed to the creation of its most formidable peer competitor, that is China.
Let me just ask you, Brad, when you say that that's clearly a mistake, I'm sorry to say that it's not, even now, even after this coronavirus, which I think has caused, well, there's an old expression, as you know, that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. There's been a lot of mugging going on, and I think a lot of Americans, as among other things, a poll just released by John McLaughlin and Associates has found that, you know, there is profound antipathy towards the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda in the United States at the moment. But there still remains around Kissinger and certainly aligned with him a coterie of elite thinkers and people who are China hands who persist in arguing that we need to be engaged with China, that this idea of decoupling from them is not possible.
Indeed, Frank, that's right. That school of thought remains strong in U.S. government, in finance, obviously, in many other in the academic community, many other communities throughout the United States. But we don't think that you're going to be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, right? That this situation, as you observed, has radically changed. And so Americans and other societies around the world are waking up to really the true nature of the Chinese Communist Party, and they're appalled by it. They're appalled that they could allow this to occur. They could lie about it, dissemble. They could use their allies in the World Health Organization and other international institutions to lie to the rest of the world, in essence, conceal information, et cetera. So as the rest of the world wakes up to this, the rest of the world is really recognizing that this was Kissinger's folly. Indeed, it was working with the Chinese Communist Party was a profound mistake, and we need to change our policies, our approach to China, so that we no longer see it as, in fact, a stakeholder, but we recognize that, in fact, it is the greatest threat that the United States and the West has ever faced.
Yes, an enemy, indeed, as you, among others, said in an open letter to President Trump last weekend, in connection with this idea of underwriting the Chinese even further through the resources of the Federal Thrift Savings Plan. An insane idea. But I did want to ask you about one thing. You mentioned that a lot of people are waking up to this. We've had reports of not only the horrible conduct of the Chinese in places like Africa, where they've been building out this Belt and Road hegemonistic colonial empire, but actually in China itself, where, you know, Africans living there have been very badly treated. There's a lot of talk in the United States at this moment, as you know, Dr. Thayer, that, you know, anybody who says any of the sorts of things that we're saying or responds to this attack against us, as President Trump is doing, for example, noting it comes from China, noting that it's a function of the malfeasance of the Chinese Communist Party, is racist. Talk about the racism of Han centrism and how that is affecting people's attitudes as well as this virus that they've unleashed on us.
Yeah, one of the major arguments that we make in the book is to recognize, that is, the West needs to recognize and the rest of the world, that Western societies transform themselves. So they've established strong cultures of anti-racism at every level, in the government, in private sector, et cetera, throughout Western societies. We went through civil rights movements and greatly transformed the societies and our ordering to much greater egalitarianism. China, of course, will never go through the civil rights movement. They're never going to go through any type of emphasis on egalitarianism, and they're going to consistently treat their racial minorities. They're going to treat the ethnic minority, the religious minorities, et cetera, extremely badly. So the incidents we have seen, there was that great Guy Scott, who was a former Zambian politician, said, we've had bad people before. The whites were bad, the Indians were worse, but the Chinese are worst of all. So that as they move into Africa, more individuals are recognizing, of course, the racism, which is still present within China, because they've never gone through any type of change or felt any need to move toward greater egalitarianism. And the party advances that and sustains it.
Yeah, and is sustained by it, I think you could say as well. So let me ask you, Brad Thayer, because we're almost out of time. You and your writing partner, Leon Chao Han, also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, have also recently published at The Hill a really interesting article about, well, you call it Carpe Diem, Seize the Day, what the U.S. must do now to capitalize on Beijing's mistakes. I assume that you would agree that one of these mistakes is the one we've just been talking about, overplaying their hand and brutalizing people that they're trying to encourage to do business with them and submit to them. But give us more generally your thesis here, and what are some of the most important vulnerabilities that we might exploit?
Well, what we need to do, of course, is recognize that the Chinese have lost tremendous goodwill in international politics as a result of the lies that they generated. So they have given the West, the United States in particular, a tremendous opportunity. We need to recognize that this is an ideological war. It's a battle for hearts and minds throughout the world. And the Chinese have aided the United States in its ability to call attention to this. The Chinese nature of the regime, dangers of totalitarianism, but also to recognize, of course, that penetration of China into societies around the world needs to be questioned. So that's an aspect of something that we can do. The reducing vulnerability within stockpiles, of course, have been extremely important. And Frank, we know that Rosemary Gibson has been the lead on this, really calling attention to this and recognizing the dangers associated with it. And if you recall the end of January 2020 Department of Homeland Security report, right, documenting the costs and consequences of China's counterfeiting and piracy practices, right? We need to call attention to that as well, recognizing that this is the time that we need to act. Thirdly, we need to recognize, too, that knowledge is something that the Chinese, we have given China. We have allowed China to enter into our intellectual ecosystems, our technological ecosystems that they've exploited ruthlessly.
Notably, academia, we'll be talking about that with Fred Flights shortly, but in our research laboratories and in many companies and seed corn producing enterprises, which we've allowed them to buy, including with money they've gotten out of our capital markets, ironically.
Again, because of the follies of Kissinger's worldview, right? The idea that by bringing China in, everybody would profit, everybody would be, and China would reform.
And we should have learned from some of Kissinger's earlier mistakes with the Soviet Union, détente and all that, that was not going to work.
The naivete is just remarkable. It's a profound misunderstanding of the nature of communist regimes. And it's equally a serious misunderstanding of China's regime and China's approach to international politics.
And Brad Thayer, we have to wrap it up here, but I just have to say that the fact that Henry Kissinger profited immensely from this mistake at the same time that he was doing such harm, and he and others like him in the globalist engagement crowd, it adds insult to injury that they've profited so handsomely. But this is a topic to which we will return, I hope, with you soon. Brad Thayer, thank you so much for what you're doing to inculcate in academia sensible attitudes towards this existential threat to freedom, and of course for your important book, How China Sees the World. Keep up the good work. Come back to us again soon if you would. Next up, Fred Flights will join us. We'll be talking with him about the fact that Vladimir Putin actually preferred Hillary Clinton, not Donald Trump, in 2016. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. I'm very proud to call a friend as well as a colleague, the extraordinary intelligence professional who is now making outsized contributions in many respects, including in his service at the center, but also in the media, on the national security challenges of our time. Fred Flights, it's always good to have you with us, but you've been doing some extraordinarily important work that I'm pleased to be able to call attention to here. Let's start, if we can, with the issues of this story that you broke, basically, that despite all that we've been told to this point, including endless recitations of the unanimous view of the intelligence community that Vladimir Putin was rooting for Donald Trump in the 2016 election, it ain't actually so. Tell us about it.
That's right, Frank. This is a blockbuster story that the media doesn't want to talk about. After all the mainstream media outlets ran a piece about 10 days ago lauding a Senate intelligence report that said that the intelligence community's analysis in January 2017 that Russia meddled in the election and helped Trump win, that that analysis was completely legitimate and followed the rules. I just decided to weigh in and make it clear that's just not true. And I revealed some things that have not been made public. And that is that House Intelligence Committee staffers, Republican staffers, have told me that based on their extensive investigation, there is conclusive evidence that the rules were not followed. But more than that, that there's evidence that John Brennan suppressed intelligence that Putin wanted Hillary Clinton to win the election and wanted Trump to lose. And this is high quality intelligence that Brennan suppressed over the objections of CIA analysts. Furthermore, there was weak intelligence that the Russians wanted Trump to win that should not have been included. It did not meet intelligence community standards. But Brennan included it over the objections of CIA analysts. And this information has yet to come out, but I understand that Acting Director of National Intelligence Grinnell has asked for all the information on the ICA, and I believe U.S. Attorney John Durham was doing an investigation of government misconduct before and after the election. My hope is he's looking at this too.
Yeah. Fred, this is indeed blockbusting. You say it's a quality intelligence. I think it's really just common sense with all that Hillary Clinton had done for the Russians over the years. She had to have been their preference. But the fact that John Brennan cooked the books, basically, on the ICA, as you call it, the Intelligence Community Assessment, it wasn't even really an intelligence community assessment, as you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere. It was a handful of hand-picked individuals who were going to hew to his party line, and the fact that he knew and had high quality intelligence that it wasn't so makes all the more scandalous what's been done here. And when you think about the damage that it's done not only to the country really but to the Trump presidency, it's staggering that this has been not only unknown until now but also that it's not getting the kind of attention that it should at this moment. Fred, let me ask you very quickly, if you would, why would there be this seeming disparity between the views of the House intelligence professionals and the Senate Intelligence Committee?
Well, the question here is the Senate report was very, very supportive of the Democratic narrative that Russia meddled in the election to help Trump win, but the House report was not. The reason is, sadly, is that the Senate Intelligence Committee is run by a very weak Republican, Senator Richard Burr, who has allowed the ranking Democrat, Mark Warner, to run the committee. And this isn't the only instance of this, and I'm not the only one who's saying that. On the other hand, Devin Nunes, who was chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has been really, really tough and has tried to push an objective analysis, despite the fact that Adam Schiff has blocked him every inch of the way and has been leaking intelligence to do everything possible to undermine this president.
Sadly, Devin Nunes is the former Intelligence Committee chairman, now the ranking member, and Adam Schiff, of course, is the chairman. Fred, I wanted to ask you quickly about something that came up in a conversation that Senator Tom Cotton had with Maria Bartiromo on the weekend about the numbers of Chinese nationals who are here as students focusing on the hard sciences. And as Senator Cotton put it, you know, it's okay if they're here studying Shakespeare and learning about the Federalist Papers, but to be trained in technologies and, you know, sciences that are going to be used against us, perhaps even militarily, is ill-advised. You've weighed in as well. Talk about it.
There's a massive effort by the Chinese government to send Chinese students here to learn all the technologies they need to dominate us militarily and economically. And it's systematic, and it's something that we have to put a stop to. And also, at a minimum, we should put a stop to allowing all Chinese student visas until China starts to negotiate on issues such as its biological research, which is endangering the world, whether this is biological weapons or not. The wet markets have to be shut down. We need answers on what's going on these laboratories in Wuhan. They're experimenting on bat viruses. But I think we should take a broader view of this. This is technology theft right under our noses, and I think Senator Cotton is exactly right.
And unfortunately, as you say, Fred Flights, it is just part of a comprehensive effort to essentially vacuum clean proprietary information, state secrets, the kinds of things that enable China to be more competitive, both commercially and in terms of its military capabilities. And that's not good for this country, that's for sure. Let me ask you about one last thing, Fred. You were one of the signatories on a letter that came out this week from national security professionals encouraging the Trump administration to continue and intensify what's been called the maximum pressure campaign on Iran. First of all, tell us a little bit about what's in the letter, the kind of people who joined you in signing it, and what's left to be done. If there's been maximum pressure, is there really further ratcheting up that can be accomplished?
Well, it was a letter with leading national security experts from the Center for Security Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, the Hudson Institute. And it's calling on the president basically to stay the course on keeping maximum pressure on Iran because it's making a difference. It's weakening Iran's ability to fund terrorism and instability in the Middle East. But there's enormous pressure on the president from the mainstream media and the Democrats to let up on these sanctions because of coronavirus, sort of like for humanitarian reasons, let's drop the sanctions that would let Iran build nuclear weapons. Obviously, that doesn't make sense, and that's what this letter is about.
Well, it's vital because I think what you're really getting at here is that, as we've been discussing throughout the program, there are those who are utilizing this pandemic crisis for their own malevolent purposes, and that's foreign powers, that's domestic adversaries, really, of our republic, and it's just infuriating. And so I hope that this will combine with what's going on the ground there, Fred Flights, to really create the kind of conditions that obviously those who are anxious to have a relaxation of these sanctions don't want to see, but conditions under which this regime may actually be replaced. Can you just say a word about how this combines with, things like drought and locust plagues and of course, the virus itself to create perhaps conditions that we might actually see the people of Iran getting this regime undone?
It's coming one day, and the people of Iran, they know what their government is. They know it lies to them. They know it's oppressive. It has an iron fist on its people right now. But I think the day is coming when that regime will be gone. And it's important that we not give sustenance to that regime and help it build weapons that will attack us and our allies. So, that's what this letter is about. And I'm confident President Trump will stay the course.
I hope he'll stay the course and indeed redouble his efforts. And that it will include, among other things, real help to the Iranian people to bring down this regime. That seems to me it ought to be in the mix as well. Fred Flights, as always, thank you very much for your time today, as well as your leadership of the Center for Security Policy. You're, I think, doing a superb job, and it's so appreciated. It's so needed, especially in this time of pandemic crisis. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.